Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Yo.
Yo. KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide.
This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years.
Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, We Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give
or call 503-231-8032.
Support KBOO
where music makes the movement.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM.
And coming up this morning, in fact, in just a few seconds, Pacific Underground welcomes Peter Turias and talks about his alternative history novels, United States of Japan and Mecha Samurai Empire. At 10, Valley View celebrates its one-year anniversary on KBOO with stories about the show's origin and plans for a future format. At 10, it's Flashpoints. Well, a little after that, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, we'll hear Radio Geekly, all of which comes to you via the auspices of your friends and neighbors and a bunch of people you've never met. Won't you be one of them? KBOO.fm. Click on the word donate. Or check out Give Guide. Let the rest of the nonprofit community know that you support community radio. And now, as promised, this is Pacific Underground.
A lot of times I find that when Asian culture is incorporated into Western media, it's a lot of times exotified, and I wanted to kind of take that out and kind of show a more normal side.
And that's the sentiment that we're having this morning. For
morning, y'all.
Yeah, Pacific Underground. This morning.
I'm Jake here, and this is with producer Jenna.
Morning. I'm still waking up. It's a little early.
We haven't had coffee yet.
I know. I literally have the coffee looking at me in a container, saying, "You should drink me." But good morning, everyone. You are tuned into Pacific Underground, the only radio show on the West Coast for the Asian and Pacific Islander community. Today, as I always say, we have for you a very special show. Because me and Jake this week, we sat down with the author, Peter Turias, author of United States of Japan and
Woo! Mecha Samurai Empire.
Okay, I'm applying because I just gotta say this interview was really fun for us. I don't know if it's gonna be fun for all the listeners, because not that it won't be fun, because it's super interesting. It's just we're a little embarrassed about this interview because we were like fanning super hard the whole time we were interviewing the author, Peter. We were just like, oh my God, and we love you, and we just want to say thank you, and we just thought your book
was so
great.
Thank you for seeing us reflected in your dystopian future as Asian Americans.
I'm just going to say, I did a lot of editing on the raw audio that we did, and it just cut out a bunch of parts where we literally are just like, I don't have a question for you. I'm just telling you that I love you. So
maybe not.
Well, it was that we loved the book.
It was a lot of fanboying and fangirling. It's a cool book.
You want to act like it's a great series. You were totally doing it. And it's okay, but so let's get into why we both love it so much.
Also, happy Pearl Harbor Day.
Oh.
Sorry.
Yeah, no. I mean, this was an intentional choice that we right. made because, okay, so first let's get into who this author is, what the book is about, and then we'll get into how it's connected to Pearl Harbor Day, or else you'll just sort of figure it out in your heads.
Right.
So Peter Tyrus authored these two books, which are this like series of books that take place in what is known as the United States of Japan, because it's a science fiction series that's based on the idea that in World War
II,
what if the United States lost, and what if Japan won, and what if Germany won, right? All the Axis powers. So it's basically based on this idea of the Man in the High Castle concept. He was strongly influenced by that. And then it was like, well, what's happening over there on the Japan side? What's happening on the Asian side? So it was, so he builds this whole world. And so you have the Japanese Empire having taken over the United States of America. Now it's called the United States of Japan.
The West Coast of the United States of America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's an interesting look at what the United States possibly could be and what Japan as a government could look like had it stayed like an expansionist empire. Yeah, for sure. So it's a book, when you look at the cover, has mechs. And if you don't know what mechs are, Jake, super sci-fi fan, what is a mech?
Okay, you're putting me on the spot here as the super nerd, but it's a giant robot, usually in like animes or some Western kind of portrayals, like Pacific Rim, but
the whole Gundam idea, man. That
giant robot pilots. With one or several pilots inside, human pilots, and Mecha Samurai Empire is more of an in-depth look at this main character Mac, who's a pilot, and he just wants to be a giant robot pilot for most of his life. That's his one dream.
And then, before Mecha Samurai Empire, you have the first book, which was the United States of Japan, that sets up this whole world. And in the United States of Japan, we follow the main character whose name is like Ben. And I say like because we actually follow quite kind of a few people in the story as it starts off at the end of World War II. And then you go forward in the story and you're looking at the 80s and a time when, you know, Japan was being seen as this new economic force, because they had Sony and all the technology and cars, you know, were just really taking over so much of the United States in terms of, like, everybody was buying the Sony radio. Everybody was driving the Toyota. They were a little more affordable. And there was a lot of discussion about, like, what is Japan going to mean to the world? And people were definitely seeing it, the Hello Kitty-ness and such, you know. And so this book instead says, well, what if none of that happened and instead you just had this super
militaristic.
Yeah, I was going to put fun in quotes.
Oh.
Is it the book? It can be quite brutally honest, as it takes a very honest look at the Japanese Empire and how violent the brutality that they inflicted upon their own people and upon others, especially others. You
it's know? Not a sort of idealized view of what would happen, or romanticized view of what would happen if Japan had won.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like there's been, like, we've kind of looked at, we went down a YouTube rabbit hole, me and Jake, and we were looking at some reviews, what people had said about, you know, the book. We were wondering how are people responding to this book, and it's interesting to see that there's people who pick up the book and they want it to be a giant robot story,
right? And they're disappointed,
yeah, because they're like, where's all the fighting action? And there is, but there's a lot of politics, feels, and the what ifs,
world building, just the non-heroic figures. There's a lot of well-fleshed-out characters, so...
Yeah, and it's, like, it's definitely this world... And we're just, like, going off about it right now.
Yeah, should we play the first clip?
We should play the first clip, but it's just, like, so interesting. And just because... Oh, I remember why we're doing this. See, the coffee still hasn't kicked in. It's because, like, in the interview, we kind of bounce around, and so we're sort of letting you know what the book is about, right? Kind of how, like, we're bouncing around right now. But so it's just, like, to realize what the discussion is we actually... were wanting to talk to him more about this world that he built rather than talking about each individual book. So you hear us in the interview reference Mecha Samurai Empire, where you have, you know, someone who's trying to learn how to become a mech pilot, and then in United States, Japan, you have someone who's trying to navigate this world of the United States of Japan. And it's a story that's, you know, there's a lot of ethnic Japanese people, but it's also still, you know, the old United States. So you have just Americans, you know, who come from all sorts of ethnic backgrounds. And then you have them having to take on, say, like Japanese names, like you saw in Korea during World War II. And now it's happening in this fictional world. And so you see a lot of things that happened historically now happening in this fictional future. And it, I don't know, just makes it begs you to ask a lot of questions and to take a look at history and modern day of like the United States, and just through many different lens, through this lens of
that's a lot of questions.
An Asian American author, it's so many levels.
Yeah.
Okay, Peter. Enough of us. It's time to get to you. So when we are starting here in this interview, we've just asked him about. What are we just asking about? We're asking him about. We were comparing Man in the High Castle and how he said he was really greatly influenced about
Philip K. Dick's
Philip K. Dick's novel. Book, and you know, and or the TV show. If you're super sucked into that, Tamlin Tamita, what's up? And he always got to say hi to the girlfriend.
Right. We Tamlin, love her sister. She's great.
Okay, and we asked him about why, you know, why take this approach to the Man in the High Castle. So here's Peter Tarius, author of Mecha Samurai Empire and United States of Japan.
And I noticed, like, several of the older Korean generation didn't like me playing the video game. And it wasn't necessarily because it was a video game, but because they still felt animosity towards anything made in Japan. And what was also interesting was that they all spoke fluent Japanese, and they actually had Japanese names from the occupation. So, like, that history was still so alive to them. And so I was very curious about that whole history and what happened back then. And then when I came back to America, again, I was shocked because there was almost nothing about that here. And so that's when I started, like, doing a lot of research and kind of exploring it. And this was on and off for a couple of years, or, like, decades, actually. And originally, I actually began exploring this through a couple different other mediums, and one of them was graphic novel. And during that time, there was so much research I was doing, I became really fascinated by it. And that's when I kind of stumbled on Man in the High Castle again. And I was reading some of the background material on Man in the High Castle, and I realized Philip K. Dick wanted to do a sequel. And then what happened was, he found the research material so disturbing, he was like, I can't get back into that world again. So he kind of put it on hold. And that's sort of when I got the idea, maybe I can make this into a spiritual sequel. And, you know, Man in the High Castle was set in the 60s, and I wanted to do something set, like, in the late 80s to the 90s, and kind of explore what that world would look like many decades later.
Yeah, it feels very much in conversation with the earlier work, since it's not taking place in the same time period. And
I, you know, with Philip K. Dick, another thing I found so compelling is, you know, he also went to Berkeley, and so a lot of times he'll write about places that I'm, you know, totally familiar with, and I found that really exciting, just in the sense that, he went to Berkeley, he didn't feel like he really belonged, and so he just, you know, kind of created his own realities, and that were really fascinating, and, you know, he always explores that question of, you know, what's it mean to actually be a human, right, and just What I found so compelling about Man in the High Castle, and I still remember it, is that it's usually you see, like, an alternate history, that kind of thing, where, you know, there'll be a clear-cut villain and a clear-cut enemy, and, you know, aside from the Nazis, but, like, all the people who live in that world, they have their own sort of values, and they're kind of doing their best to survive, and they know, like, the system is wrong, but at the same time, it's part of who they are, and it's part of what they grew up with, so they can't, it's not like they clearly understand that, oh, this whole reality is the wrong, you know, reality. Whereas for us, because we know the Axis Party's lost, we can see that and we go, oh, you know, there's, like, this whole multiple layers going on there. And I found just, like, that whole struggle and conflict between the different thematic ideas and the different alternate histories with our own history to be really, really fascinating. This is not a knock against Philip K. Dick, and because I love his writing and it's been a deep influence on me. But one of the areas that I found I was kind of disappointed in, and not necessarily in him, was in the book, the I Ching plays such an important part, right? And just, like, you know, predicting the world and just, you know, how everything works out, which I found absolutely fascinating. But when I spent some time in China, I would ask around, like, do you guys use the I Ching? And it was like, no, that's like old style. Like, it's very antiquated. Oh. And I just found that idea, like, I really wanted to do something that was more relevant and contemporary. And a lot of times I find that when Asian culture is incorporated into Western media, it's a lot of times exotified. And I wanted to kind of take that out and kind of show a more normal side. So you can see when I talk about the life in the United States or Japan, a lot of it's about, you know, going to find different types of food just having fun, right? And just like day-to-day stuff where you're just kind of embracing, you're not like necessarily pointing out the exotic nature of it, but more it's just a fabric of what's there, right?
Feels very normalized, like you said.
I really enjoy the world that you built in United States of Japan, because the Japanese-ness of this world was just so, it felt so authentic, or it spoke to me a lot as a Japanese person. That
thank you.
I feel like other sci-fi novels have not, because it just feels like it's coming from a much different perspective of just sort of seeing Japan as this economic force that, you know, went through World War II and they lost, and so now they're Sony and they're all these like great technological things. While in the United States of Japan, they still have the technology, but it's under the influence of what imperialistic Japan possibly could be these days. And I feel like so much more of the culture of Japanese-ness is expressed as a result, as opposed to just constantly talking about technology that, you know, we see that lens now from that 80s view. So I don't know. I don't even know if I have a question. I just wanted to say, like, this was an amazing book for me to just see how you influenced or how the Japanese-ness is influenced in it while it's still very American too. And it was just, when you were talking about the food, it's like, I wanted to eat at the places in the book.
Thank you. I think for me, like, just trying to get the authentic nature of it was really important. And then what was also really, what played a really key role in this was that I got to work very closely with my Japanese publisher, Hayakawa, and they gave lots of feedback in terms of, like, they would say, hey, this is wrong, or, you know, make sure you adjust this, or, you know, like, they were constantly in there kind of giving a lot of editorial feedback, and I felt that made a really huge difference. To me, what was also interesting was I wanted to point out some of the differences, but I also wanted to point out some of the similarities. And I find that really interesting in that when people read USJ, they go, wow, this is such a dystopian world. And yet, like, I kind of ask them, like, have you seen the news recently? Especially if you see the news from the perspective of outside of America, right? Where people are looking in and their view is a lot less rosy. And I think just trying to be authentic about it and just trying to recreate this kind of, you know, because I think a part of why a lot of, like, at least for me, why I feel a lot of times uncomfortable with whenever, you know, Asian culture is exotified is that it makes you feel like an outsider or like a stranger within your own skin, right? I mean, just to use a cliche. A lot of times what's normal for us seems so strange and foreign to other people. And so I wanted to really capture, you know, how it feels just for if this was normal, right? If this was just everyday life rather than, oh, you know, look at this, you know, specific Asian thing over here and there, you know? So then it becomes almost like an alienating factor rather than something that kind of binds and unites people. Yeah, thank you. I'm so happy to hear that.
And that's one of the things as a non-Japanese person that kind of made the world feel very lived in and a little bit more real to me was the aspect of assimilating into Japanese-ness and taking being forced to take Japanese surnames and identities, which makes sense now that you say you talked to some of the Korean elders from, you know, before the war, and that was the Japanese policy. But, you know, I had grandparents who, like, till late in life had a lot of bitterness towards Japanese people, you know, from the Philippines, and because of their experiences in the war. And so to be able to show that sort of nuance was very interesting.
Yeah, and I think what was also fascinating was just reading some of the accounts, because I went back and read a lot of the accounts from World War II from the Japanese side, specifically like the civilian side. And what I found to be a point of understanding where I could relate was a lot of them didn't know what was going on outside, right? So they didn't know, you know, what was actually going on during World War II. And in the same sense, like when I think here in America, we started finding more about what was going on in the Iraq war. It was very, at least for me, it was very shocking. And just, you know, reading some of the death tolls of civilians in the Iraq war, like from their perspective, what we did, obviously, you know, we weren't like the, you know, American heroes, right? And so, like, I kind of struggled with the whole idea of, like, are we as civilians, we as Americans, how responsible are we for what happens overseas, right? Like, how will history judge us? And, like, how even we're seeing within our own lifetime, like, whole wars and whole, like, you know, everything is being already rewritten within our own eyes, where things are, things clearly that should not have happened are being justified, right? And so that also, as a writer, that's, there's a sense of responsibility in that. Like, how do we address those issues, and how do we, like, tackle that, both as Asian Americans and just also as just, you know, human beings, right? Those are, like, the kind of difficult things that I try to tackle in both books. I think with USJ, I kind of hit it more on the head, whereas Mecca, I try to be a little more subtle because it's from the perspective of students. So for a lot of these students, like, how much would they know about what's really going on outside their borders, right? And a lot more of what they're being taught would be more like propaganda, or at least censored and filtered. Their curriculum is very, you know, censored and filtered. So from right. their perspective, what they're doing is glorious and good, right? Whereas, you know, the victims outside the borders might not view it that way.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Pacific Underground, and this is an interview with author Peter Tarias, the author of Mecha Samurai Empire and United States of Japan. Mecha Samurai Empire came out in 2018. United States of Japan came out in 2016. And I'm joined here with Jake. Morning, Jake.
Morning.
A little more awake now, maybe?
A little bit better.
A little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah,
we had a couple sets of coffee there
while we were listening. Donut.
to that interview.
Delicious donuts. Shout out for the Asians.
Delicious donuts. So, yeah, I'm liking this interview.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we did it, but I like listening to it again because of all the interesting things that he's got to say about, you know, how, yeah, this is about a world that is a science fiction world, but it definitely, like all really good science fiction, is a reflection upon our reality and gives us a chance to take a look at ourselves and to say, like, well, what is that? What is our role in in larger structures? And
what's the relationship to power and, like, history and memory? You can tell that every choice in there is, like, very intentionally made. So
if you haven't read these two books, which you should go do that right now.
Why haven't you?
Why haven't you done that? United States of Japan and Mecha Samurai Empire are two science fiction stories that definitely have mecha robots, the gigantic robots that are piloted by people. And it takes place in a world where the United States has lost World War II, and so now it's the United States of Japan on the West Coast. You have Men in the High Castle happening on the East Coast. And these two books are exploring those worlds and mainly exploring the people within those worlds, less about the government structures and more about how it affects everyday people from this occupational force. So we're going to continue. And Jake, what are you about to ask him in, like, the next clip?
I forget. What was it? You just played it for me.
I'm trying to set that one up there for you. So we're going to talk to him more about, well, all the stuff we've been talking about, more about, like, identity. We're going to be talking just so much about why are you writing this, taking this, you know, take on the Asian American, or I guess Asian, it's not Asian American anymore in that story, it's Japanese occupational empireness.
Yeah, and
Let's get to it. We're like, oh, we're going to ramble some more. Don't do that. We did that in when we first introed this. So here we go. Let's get back to Peter Tarias, author of Mecha Samurai Empire and United States of Japan.
What do you think's the most surprising or interesting thing that you found about how fans in Japan or China have reacted as compared to fans in the U.S.?
Well, with China, okay, so China, it's very interesting too, because in China, it came out about a month ago, and that's only United States or Japan. And I think in Japan, they really emphasized the mecha aspect of it, which was super cool. But in China, they actually got rid of the mecha in the marketing material completely. And they only focused on, like, sort of the dystopian culture. And I found, and that was very interesting for me, because it actually made me wonder, like, how different USJ would have been received, because a lot of people went in expecting, like, a sci-fi mecha, you know, mecha fighting robot action book, and they were like, whoa, this is like actually almost like a it is a spiritual successor to Madame High Castle, but I was also influenced by 1984. And there's little Easter eggs about that, like the fact that Ben is 39, just like Winston in 1984 was 39, and little things like that, little nods. And so I remember when I first read 1984 a long time ago, everyone around me was like, oh my God, you know, this is such a horrible totalitarian society. But for me, I was like, who are the thought police? Like, I want to know more about them. Like, what goes on behind the scenes? What's like their history, right? And I think that came up with Akiko, where I really got into that. And so just to see that aspect appreciated in China, I found very interesting. And in Japan, reception overall, like I'm honestly surprised all the time by just what fans will do and just like kind of their enthusiasm for both USJ and Mecha Samurai Empire. And you know, as a writer, it's like a huge honor, right? Because I think the biggest fear for a lot of writers isn't being hated or even criticized; it's being completely ignored, right?
Yeah.
And so just to get this kind of reception for me is super exciting. And I think I don't know, like if for. In terms of my own writing background, if I can get into that a little, I struggled a lot getting my stories published. I know there's some people who, you know, their first novel gets, you know, published, New York Times bestseller and whatnot. But for me, I spent like years just getting short stories published, and it was just like rejection after rejection after rejection. And I think there was like a 4 or 5 year period where I got every short story I sent out rejected. Wow. And I really was at the point where I was like, you know, maybe I'm just not being realistic and I'm not meant to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And it was a very difficult time for me because I'm like, oh, I'm so passionate about these stories. And I think what was interesting also during that time was I loved science fiction and fantasy stories, but a lot of the feedback I was getting was, you know, try not to write so much science fiction and fantasy stories and, you know, try to write more immigration and family type stories.
Oh,
so I found that feedback very interesting. And so what was exciting for me that changed a lot of things was there was a lot of Asian American writers who were coming up and starting to publish science fiction stories, like Ken Liu is one. And there's so many out there now, or there's a lot more out there now, and so they're kind of paving the way. So I'm super grateful to them to kind of open the doors. So for me, what really changed things was, you know, starting when I started getting more short stories accepted. And what was great for me though was during that time of rejection, I actually started like broadening my scope as a writer. So I started writing more nonfiction essays, video game articles, doing interviews, book reviews and stuff. So that really helped me to grow as a writer. And I find that very useful because for now, if I don't suffer writer's block as much anymore, but if I ever do, then I'll be like, okay, let me go write a video game article, or let me go write an essay about, you know, whatever topic that's, you know, on my mind. And so I find a lot of times then when I'm doing research for like the nonfiction stuff, I'll get inspired for my own creative writing, which I find really, really helpful. So again,
really cool.
It was kind of like this thing where it was a very desperate time where I was like, you know, I will never make it as a writer. And you kind of see that in Mecha Samurai Empire, where he desperately wants to be a mecha pilot, but everyone keeps on rejecting him, right?
Right.
Some
that
of those
was
struggles are
such an interesting hero's journey as compared to the stereotypical mecha pilot who's the chosen one, right? The guy Max, kind of a loser, right? He's a guy that like things don't go right for him. And like, he gets rejected from the academy like twice or something like that. I forget. But,
yeah, no, that was really important to me because I remember like a couple times, like at conferences, Asian American fans would come up to me, and the thing that they pointed out that they loved was they said, "Thank you for writing ordinary Asian characters." And I found that so interesting because I was like, "What? What's that mean, right?" But if you look at like Ben and Mac and, you know, Akiko's a little extraordinary, but like, you know, because just in terms of like her status, but a lot of the characters are very like just ordinary, right? And they fail a lot. And I feel it's really important for a lot of Asian Americans to realize it's okay to fail, right? It's okay not to be the best. And just to, that's not what life's about, right? And I think with Mac, like I think of books in terms of themes. So like for me, United States of Japan, as one word, I would say sacrifice is the theme. And in Mecha Samurai Empire, it's persistence. And I think for me, the more important thing that I find compelling about Mac is that he just keeps on trying despite all the odds being against him. And in a sense, like, again, that parallels me as a writer. When I was trying to get stuff published, I just felt like I'm just not destined to be a writer, right?
Right.
Because I just, like, rejection after rejection after rejection. It was just like a very destitute time for me. And just to be able to channel that, and just to channel, like, you know, everyday life, there's like little defeats, right? That were right. Little things that'll just, you know, people will do things to humiliate you or just embarrass you. And then, you know, but you have to keep on struggling, right? Because otherwise you just get crushed underneath, right? So, yeah, that's kind of what I hope to do. And what I hope, I really hope it can inspire people to just say, you know, I might not be the best at something, but I'm just going to still keep on trying and chase my dreams, as cheesy as that sounds. So.
It definitely resonated with me because I felt, as somebody who loves sci-fi, you know, since I was a kid, and reading all these Bradbury, Vonnegut, you know, Philip K. Dick, I never really saw myself reflected in that. And to, you know, see, you know, Asian American stories are only accepted if they're, like, you know, about a certain sort of tokenizing racial marker. Yeah. And sci-fi stories only being accepted if they portray a certain kind of settler narrative, right? Mm-hmm. And how important was that for you to sort of, like, break that?
Oh yeah, I mean, that's why I'm writing, right? I can't write any other type of story. And I think in many ways, like, when I look back, like, these are the kind of stories that I felt drawn to, because I know Ender's Game, that's an example, where a lot of people love that book, and I had a hard time identifying with the main character because he was just naturally gifted and talented, and that's not the way I am at all. I wanted to see, like, a hero reflective of who I am, like, and how, like, I struggle with everything. Like, I, you know, when I was at school, I struggled with grades, right? Like, everyone around me, like, they were like, oh, you're the Asian kid, you should be really good at math and this and this, and I was like, struggled so much. Yeah, so because of all that, I really want to show a character who fails a lot. And that, to me, was why I wrote Mecha Samurai Empire. I wouldn't have written otherwise, because I feel like it wouldn't have contributed anything. And also, it adds a realism to it, because I think a lot of the mecha anime that I see, the characters are so extraordinary at being pilots. But how are they extraordinary, right? Like, if me and you, no matter how smart we were, if we got into a jet and tried to fly it, without any instructions, we would probably crash and die, right? Yeah. And so for a mecha, which is much more complex, I feel like, you know, it adds a sort of realism to it. And it also helps with the world building, because getting a sense of where, like, the mechas came from, like, how they work, what the training is like, it helps establish kind of the culture, you know, and, like, the backdrop to it. And so, like, everything ends up contributing to that. So with United States of Japan, the very first thing I wrote was the ending. Like, I knew the ending for that, so I don't want to spoil it, but, like, and everything went backwards from that. And so for me, like, a lot of times finding the theme, then I can also get into the world building. So I feel like that's something that's really important to me, is that all the world building there is fascinating and super cool, but at the same time, it has to contribute to the story. And so that can be everything from, like, the food, you know, there's all the different elements, but there's also, like, within the food, it's like, oh, what cultures are they incorporating? And that actually plays in it kind of informs you about what's going on in that world, aside from, like, Easter eggs, you know, with the food stuff. And then also just, like, everything from what, you know, what kind of movies do they watch, or, you know, what kind of political shows, what kind of concerts, and what kind of operas they watch, you know, and just getting into all that world building, you know.
Oh, that's great. So your popularity in the U.S. did that not pick up until it was after already it was a bestseller in Japan?
In terms of the U.S., like, Japan is still, like, I think, where it's more popular. But yeah, I mean, they kind of went hand in hand. And so there were, like, a couple really awesome articles about and reviews about United States of Japan. So that really helped it. And I think, like, I always thank Andrew Liptak at IO9, because his review, it had over 100,000 views. And, like, I remember I went to a conference and everyone was talking about it, like, hey, I saw your book on IO9. And that was, like, a really big moment for me. So I think it's, you know, in terms of, like, just the reception and the resonance it's had with people, it's been really cool. And then also, obviously, Madame High Castle being popular and sort of the books being tied together has been super cool for me. So Joel De La Fuente, he did the audiobook for Mecha Samurai Empire, and he plays Inspector Kido in the Man in High Castle TV show. So that was a really cool connection too. So and I loved his audiobook or his narration. Yeah, if you haven't, I highly recommend checking out the audiobook.
Oh, yeah, definitely give that a look. I mean, if you don't mind me asking about your ethnic identity, because as a non-Japanese person, because you're not Japanese either, and you know, as a non-Japanese person, I read it as sort of just having it's so difficult to sort of like be, you know, write about a community that you're not in, you know, respectfully, but also you know, show the nuance of the communities that were affected by that, you know, imperial kind of thing. And so like, how did you skirt that line?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think for me, like, and I really emphasize this, it's that I was writing about what an occupied country would look like. So if you see in both my books, it never takes place in actual Japan. It always takes place in America. And so again, like I was drawing, like I was mentioning, I was drawing on my own history and the things that I learned from the occupied countries, like in Korea and China, and just all the stories I heard from that, right? And so also like drawing on making this parallel America, right? So what's interesting is that because of the United States of Japan, I often get asked to write stories specifically about Japan. And I've actually turned down each time because I tell them, please find someone who's actually Japanese, because I feel like what I write, again, like if you see the characters, they're all either mixed or, you know, if there are pure Japanese characters or like in, you know, authority figures or like Kujira. So because I really want to be respectful of that. So I think for me, again, like I'm drawing the perspective of, you know, an America under Japanese rule rather than Japan itself. So if I were to actually show in that world what Japan was like, it would be very different from the United States of Japan. So I actually put in that line in Mecha Samurai Empire where it says, you know, the way people act in the United States of Japan is very different from, say, you know, the southern part of America or in Japan itself or in Asia. So I think just having that sort of distinction and just being very clear about that, I thought was really important. So again, and then another big factor was that I was working very closely with Naoya Nakahara, who's my translator, and my editor Ayatobo. So they gave, again, like they gave tons of really good feedback in terms of like, you know, hey, you used the wrong word here, or you did, you know, this is not right, or this would never happen, and you know, just making sure to work closely with them. So I think with Nakahara-san, what was great was I felt more, even though he was the translator, he was also a collaborator, and that he actually contributed a lot of elements to the book. So like for example, Kujira, in the Japanese edition, he actually speaks with a Kansai dialect. And so his whole backstory, where he's from Osaka, that came about because of his decision to give him the Kansai dialect. And the Mecha Samurai Empire actually came out in Japan before America. So that was like, you know, again, like just getting a lot of the feedback and just hearing to make sure that everything was, you know, in line and nothing was like, you know, everything was culturally appropriate and respectful. I found that really important.
All right, if you're just tuning in, you're here listening to Pacific Underground. I'm Jake, and here with Jenna, and we're listening to an interview we did last week with author Peter Tarias of Mecha Samurai Empire and United States of Japan.
So coming up in this next part of the interview, he starts by talking about, the opening of United States of Japan, so... Not a spoiler, because this is just, you know,
first
couple pages. So I'm going to ruin it. If you're about to read page two, like turn off your radio for just like 1 minute and then opening it. So spoiler, it opens in Manzanar, which is a Japanese American concentration camp, actually the one that my family went to. And it starts with the prisoners there at the camp wondering where did all the American soldiers go that were guarding them.
And not to mention, sorry to interrupt, it was in 1948, so theoretically after the U.S. had been losing the war for several years. And so as sort of repressive as some of those camps were for the people in there, like they were at least saved by not being associated with the, you know, like... not having Japan like almost like on the shore or like being invading. So the repressive measures would have been a lot worse.
So United States, Japan, here you have people in Manzanar where the our you know reality history is people were let go at the end of World War II. But here in this book, United States of Japan, which is the science fiction fantasy novel, where you have now the Japanese occupational forces come in and say, hey, you're free, which is a really interesting alternate reality. So I was asking him about this and mentioning to him, you know, this was something I had never even really had imagined, even as somebody who had family there. We never talked about this in our family of what would that have been like if suddenly the war had ended differently. So it was an interesting take on what it was, because it's not a glorification where it's, oh, this is this really great thing. People are free. It gets pretty Japanese empire-rific, meaning
right away.
Horrific right away, because that's how the occupational forces did it back then. So let's get back to our interview with Peter Torais of Mecha Samurai Empire and United States of Japan.
I felt like in Man in the High Castle, it never addressed that. I mean, what shocked me, you know, and should shock all Americans, is that it happened just decades ago. And anyone who is even, I think, a 16th Japanese, so that's like your great-grandfather, you were sent to the camps. And then, you know, like all the talk these days of, you know, the Muslim camps and stuff, like this is stuff that can happen even now, right? And it's so relevant and so important to know what happened and just to be able to talk about that and realize that, you know, this really, like, this is not just some, you know, foreign concept or some part of history. It's like part of now, right? And it's really important that we understand that and know it. And thank you so much. I'm very touched to hear that. So thank you.
Both of us have lived in the Bay Area in the past, and just to see sort of to be able to imagine what was visited on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, by nuclear weapons, leveling San Jose, with the giant robot. It was just very much like you didn't take anything that didn't happen already, but just sort of changed some of the details and kind of like reversed it to see, you know, like it very much... You know, it was very much humanizing to, the people on the imperial side. But also, yeah, I didn't see myself reflected in any Asian American characters in Man in the High Castle. So,
yeah, with that question, like, I struggled a lot with it, because I obviously want to be very respectful of what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and my perspective on that was just the fact that people were debating it, and it'd be like the whole topic had become academic, like, should we have dropped the bomb, should we not have, like, you know, what did we know, what versus what we didn't know. And that to me is horrifying, because like these people's lives aren't like an academic subject to debate. And I think a lot of times when you view it from the purely American perspective, it becomes academic. But if you reverse that and it's about the deaths of Americans, or, you know, it could be anyone, right? If it's your own people, like, how does that change the narrative and the whole topic and the way you approach it? And so that's kind of what I really want to talk about. So again, like, I was really trying to be sensitive to it, because I know a lot of these topics are extremely sensitive, right? And rightly so. So, I mean, honestly, I was very, like, stressed out about, like, when the book came out. I was like, oh, you know, how's it going to be received and stuff like that. So again, like, I just took, like, we just spent so much time just editing, revising, and, you know, re-editing and making sure or trying our best to be as respectful as possible with that.
One of the quote that I kept thinking of, you know, several times when I was reading United States of Japan was from Toni Morrison, where she says, if there's a book that you want to read, but it hasn't been written yet, then you must write it.
I am so grateful to my publishers for giving me this opportunity, and to all the fans and readers out there who gave the book a chance, right? You know, because I have Mecha Samurai Empire and a third book that I'm getting to explore the universe in, and then I'm done. But I'm really grateful for that, because I know, like, you can't ever take that for granted, I think, as a writer, like, because, you know, it's like the whole publishing industry is changing a lot, and no one knows where it's kind of going. And a lot of times, like, it's very interesting, because there used to be a lot more room for discovery of new writers, right? and there were a lot more bookstores, like even Barnes & Noble, when there was news that, you know, they might be bought out by someone else. Like, how's that going to change the industry, right? Because a lot of times Barnes & Noble is like the main place where you might find new writers, because a lot of times online, you're probably going to go to the same writers that you're familiar with, right? Either you're familiar with, or it's something, an IP based off like a movie or a TV show or something, right? So just that there's space for it, and that people were open to it, and enjoyed it, and also engaged in discussions about it, I found very very cool, and super honored by it. And again, at the same time, I know because these topics are so controversial, some of them, like, some people struggle with it, and I think a lot of it was because they're not as familiar with the history. And what I appreciate was then a lot of these people would then go find out more about the history, and then they'd be like, oh, this is what the background for the stories were. And to me, like, just to be able to spur a conversation at a deeper level, that to me is really what's, you know, meaningful for me, and what I, if there's anything I hope for, that's what it would be.
Do you feel like you're getting a lot of support from the Asian American community? Like, what has been the response here in the United States?
You know, I think, I mean, overall, everyone's been super positive. So I think, I'm not actually sure how to answer that, because in the sense that everyone's been super positive and super, you know, supportive. So I think, I don't know if that's over, you know, like a lot or small, but like, I'm, you know, to me, like, whoever supports it, I'm so grateful to them. So,
I guess it's kind of hard to know always who your readers are. Doing this way.
Yeah. Right. Have most of your reading events been at like sci-fi conventions or something?
Yeah, no, it's been a mix. So I, you know, I'll do sometimes readings with other people, and you know, but I think at conferences and conventions, it's been more like panels.
Mm.
So like getting to talk about alternate history or like, you know, technology and stuff like that in science fiction. So what's interesting about a lot of the conferences and conventions is that there's very few Asian Americans in the audience. So, and I didn't, it was weird because I didn't realize it, but like a lot of these places are predominantly non-Asian, right? So I didn't realize, like, because, you know, in the West Coast, I think in the East Coast, there's a lot more diversity. So that to me was very like eye-opening, because I think even with United States and Japan, there were certain moments where they asked me to simplify some of the terminology just to make it more accessible. And that was something I was totally okay with. I said, yeah, sure, no problem. But like now, just seeing a lot of the audience out there for sci-fi conferences, I kind of understood that. But at the same time, I really do think, having said that, I really do think there's a lot more Asian American readers out there. And I think it's also, as long as, you know, these opportunities are being created where, you know, there's books out there that can reach Asian Americans. And there, you know, again, there's so many great Asian American authors out there, and a lot more, like, just, you know, just coming up and just like writing amazing books. So I my hope is that it continues to expand and grow, and as long as they're out there.
All right, well, is there any thoughts you want to leave us with, Jenna?
Wait, Peter? Okay, couple questions. Don't just wrap things
up.
Oh,
sorry, I'm wrapping it up too soon.
Because he mentions book number three, and we're just gonna let that gloss by. Do
we gotta ask about book?
We
number
gotta
three.
Ask book. Okay, so when is book number three?
I don't know the exact date. I turned it in for editing, so I'm waiting with my editor. And the whole idea is it's a revolution takes place within the United States of Japan. There's a corrupt governor who takes over. And so, like, this revolutionary group decides to do something about him.
Are we going to see a return of characters from your previous two books, or is this its own kind of separate story?
It's going to be a standalone book again. So each of the books is a complete standalone. So it's almost like an anthology series where each of the characters has their own arc and then it ends. But there's cameos of, you know, other characters from the past. But, like, this focuses on two new characters. So if you, in United States of Japan, there was a character, General Wakana. And he actually had two sons. So this is this takes place about 20 years after USJ. So his son is one of the main characters in the new book. And then there's a whole new character named Reiko Morikawa, and she's like a mega pilot as well. So she's one of the. There's like two main characters in this one. I'm really excited about this because it's almost like a merging of USJ and Mecha, where I think in Mecca, I went away from more of the political aspects of it and focused more on the Mecca battles, whereas this is more of a balance between USJ and Mecca Samurai Empire. And so there's a lot of political conspiracies and, you know, whatnot, but there's also like these massive Mecca battles. So, and it's actually deeply influenced by Metal Gear Solid 2, The Sons of Liberty, which gets into a lot about what our culture does with this information glut, right? And the whole idea there was, like, because there's so much information now out there online and none of it is being sort of funneled or channeled, how do you kind of decide what you want to do, right? So, like, in terms of, like, how we spend our time, there are so many great games, so many great TV shows, so many great books, right? So many good movies. Like, how do you balance what you watch and what you view, right? And just, you know, just aside from all the official channels, like, you can go on YouTube and find, like, amazing, you know, people and all these different, you know, YouTube channels and, you know, shows and stuff like that. So, and in terms of a society where you get so much overload, an overload of information, like, how do you, what gets funneled? How does, you know, how is there any sort of guidance in that? Or, like, how do you find yourself in that, right? And those are the kind of questions about identity that I found really fascinating. So with a revolution, like, you know, obviously there's a corrupt governor in charge, but also it's about the people who kind of try to funnel that, the thought police, getting into more of that and, like, how they function and really getting into the structure of that and the culture.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO 90.7. I'm Jake, and I'm here with Jenna.
Morning.
We
that was an interview with the author Peter Tarius.
Yeah.
Of Mecha Samurai Empire, a United States of Japan. If you are interested in learning more about Peter or going to learn about the book, look him up on all the Amazons and all the stuff. You can purchase that book, or you can follow him on Twitter at Peter Shu. Do all the socials. It's really good. It's a really good book. It's if you're one of those people who are even one of those people who are like, oh, I'm not really so into sci-fi and robots, and this, I think, is a really good kind of introduction to that world where it's like Men in the High Castle. You're like, oh, science fiction. Then you're like, oh man, that just made me, that really had to make me challenge my worldview. And
it's a way of talking about kind of things in this reality, but
okay, let's talk about, so, well, yeah.
Thanks. So thanks again to Peter for talking to us.
Thank you.
Hope we did you justice.
Go on to kbo.fm. We have links on there. You can read more about him, and you can always hear the full length of that interview back on our webpage, kbo.fm. Okay, in our last few minutes here, we got like 5 minutes or so. We're going to talk about some realities. We're going to talk about the reality of Pacific Underground. We're like in a little transition phase. We've, every year or so, I want to say, we go through a little transition-y thing. Like a year ago, Jake joined, or a year and a half ago or so. Wow, we've, like, anyhow, the big announcement is that this is my last show.
Oh, don't go, Jenna.
I know, I don't want to go. This is, like, sad for me. This is sad for me to have my last show, because I've been on Pacific Underground since episode 2. I think that was my first show, was that I was actually a guest.
Oh, wow.
And for a segment we used to have called Your English is So Good, and I shared a story about when I first went to New Seasons here in Portland, and that segment was called Are You Gonna Teriyaki That? So just that's also on kbo.fm.
If you want to hear Baby Blast from the Past, Baby Jenna, check that out.
Back when she was just in her mid-30s as opposed to her late-30s.
Oh, God.
So, but yeah, no, everybody else will still be carrying forward. We still got Kat, although she's going to be muting a little time, too. But we still got Jake.
Period of transition. Tabitha.
Still got new members Sarah and Matt to carry on the only show on the West Coast for Asians and Pacific Islanders.
And one of only two in the U.S.,
yeah, what about two of us?
Holding it down.
Yeah, go you guys. Go you guys. Carrying the torch. We got a lot of good stuff coming up. We have all sorts of shows planned and stuff, but I'll still be around here at the KBOO as a volunteer and still doing all sorts of stuff. So, you know, it's not goodbye forever.
Yeah.
But it's just me taking a step back from Pacific Underground. And I just want to thank everyone for years of support and for
all our listeners.
All our listeners, and for all of our guests, and to all my friends who put up with me posting things on Facebook like, oh my God, it's Vox Pop time. Please, please help, help. Please lend me your opinions. And, you know, it's been a really awesome way to get to know the community and to even get to know my friends. Because we don't always talk necessarily about, like, identity in a way that's, like, interviewee. You just sort of, like, you know, chill with your friends or whatever.
It just is.
And so then all of a sudden it's like, hey, let's talk about so many different issues that we talked about, specifically around, like, mental health. We've talked about family. We've talked about food. We've talked about chihuahuas. We've talked about poetry.
Crazy Rich Asians.
We've talked about Crazy Rich Asians on many, many different levels. Oh.
Not just the movie.
You know, and we said we were going to mention this, so we got to mention this. Okay, so thanks, everyone. It's been fun. Stop by, Kaboo. Say hi to me. If I'm here at the station, well, we'll share some tea. We need to mention that today is Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, and it's a weird kind of day because people in the United States don't really remember it anymore, I want to say. Even people don't always know what the event is when you talk about it. People in Japan definitely don't talk about it.
In any other country?
Yeah. And so that's why we decided to put the United States to Japan on today to talk about, like, well, what, how that would have been different in World War II had Japan won and America lost. And, you know, and as a Japanese American, it's a complicated issue because I'm American, but I'm Japanese, and my family was definitely affected by that day. But I definitely don't necessarily feel like, oh, yeah, you know, Japan was totally in the right. And, you know, I definitely don't feel that way. I just, it's so complicated. It's so complicated. And I wish that violence didn't have to happen at all. Like, why do people need to be bombing one another to, quote unquote, create peace?
Yeah. So, why do we need greater East Asian co-prosperity spheres? We don't. Why do we need, I don't know, a lot of things.
Yeah. So thank you, Peter, for helping us maybe reimagine what it could be. And thank you, Pacific Underground, for all these years helping me work out my own feels on air and work through those discussions about what is it to have your patriotism questions and then to have, you know, your own feels about your own motherland and looking at them very critically and saying, really? What does that mean for myself?
The opportunity to try out eyelid tape.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I tried eyelid tape on this show for the first time. So I just got to put a little appeal out there in our last minute here or so on air that if you are an Asian American, Asian Pacific Islander American identifying person and you're like, hey, I would like to work out my feels live on air. I really encourage everyone to join the Pacific Underground Collective. We're always looking
for open spot.
Yeah. Yeah. Here, come sit right here. Literally, come sit here, sit in the seat and discuss. And yeah, you don't have to be located in Portland to join in on the discussion or to help out on the collective. So we're best contacted through Facebook or through our email address, which is pacificunderground@kboo.org. And for the last time, ever, I'm going to sign off by saying that we still stand in solidarity with all those here in our KBOO community who are asking and begging for systemic change. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Good morning.
Good morning. We'll be right back.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host the Holiday Comics Spectacle of Artists on Parade on Thursday, December 13th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Holiday Comics Spectacle of Artists on Parade features 20 Portland comic artists who will read their works. The event also features live cello heavy metal, sing-alongs, treats, and more. Again, that's the Holiday Comics Spectacle of Artists on Parade on Thursday, December 13th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Fiesta Flamenca Navideña on December 16th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Alberta Abbey in Portland. Fiesta Flamenca Navideña features traditional holiday songs, student and Espacio Flamenco Company performances, and a flamenco sing-along. There will also be snacks and beverages. Again, that's Fiesta Flamenca Navideña on Sunday, December 16th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Alberta Abbey, 126 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, guess what, cats and kitties? It's 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland, and we're going to be hearing from Valley Views. One whole year of Valley Views from the bountiful Willamette Valley in Corvallis. That's right. We're going to round out the hour with most of yesterday's flashpoints via KPFA in Berkeley and the Pacifica Network. We thank our siblings in struggle for sharing that with us. Regional solidarity, y'all. At 11 o'clock, a Radio Geekly looks back at the life of publisher Stan Lee, visits the local holiday craft fair, Geek the Halls, and a visit to the D&D pop-up tavern, Orcs, Orcs, Orcs. All of this is possible only with your support.